You're listening to Writers on Writing, a show about the art, craft, and business of writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guest today is Ivy Pacoda, the author of the critically acclaimed novels Wonder Valley, Visitation Street, and These Women, a New York Times best thriller of 2020. These Women was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, the Edgar Award, California Book Award, the McCavity Award, and the International Thriller Writers Award. Ivy teaches creative writing at the Studio 526 Skid Row. Her latest novel, Sing Her Down, was nominated for a Los Angeles Times Book Prize, and because we recorded our talk prior to the awards next Friday, April 19th, we don't yet know the winner of the crime fiction category. Hopefully it will be Sing Her Down. I'm a fan of her work. You can find prior conversations at writersonwriting.com. On the show, we talked about writing during the pandemic, multiple point of view characters, setting, twists, keeping track, prologues, and so much more. And now for my talk with Ivy Pacoda. So Ivy, I'm so glad to talk to you about Sing Her Down. Before we get onto the book, though, talk about your journey to writing for those listeners who aren't familiar with your material or with you.
Well, I came to writing in a very roundabout way, although to me it seems like the only way to do it. I always wanted to do something in the arts, but I took a detour through playing professional squash, which is a lesser known sport, although squash has finally been included in the Olympic Games and will be in the Olympic Games the first time in Los Angeles, so maybe more people will know what it is. While I was competing on the professional squash tour, I just felt a little bit dissatisfied with only being an athlete. It wasn't for me. I mean, other people have that mentality. I don't. And I started to write, and I wrote a book that was pretty unhinged and undisciplined called The Art of Disappearing, which I really love. I eventually went to graduate school and wrote a second novel that I thought was going to be the Great American Novel. But was marketed as a mystery, which was a happy accident because I got to become part of the mystery crime community, which is not anywhere I ever expected to see myself. And it's also somewhere that I feel completely at home. I can't imagine my writing life without being part of the crime community. I sort of go back and forth between several worlds in fiction, but my home is with my crime brothers and sisters, or they say brothers and sisters in crime, I guess. So yeah, it was a weird journey, but for me, it seems perfectly normal.
What about that first novel? When I hear you mention it, I mean, you do kind of talk lovingly about it, but you usually laugh a little bit, or you chortle maybe.
Yeah, I love it. It's called The Art of Disappearing. It's a book about a woman who marries a magician the day they meet or shortly thereafter, and he is actually capable of magic. He can make things disappear, people disappear. He sort of can do things he doesn't quite understand. And I think there's a lot of great ideas in the book. As someone who came to write about place really specifically as one of the guiding frameworks for a lot of my fiction. I set this book initially in Las Vegas, a place I'd barely been to. And it's so strange to me. When I wrote the book, I thought fiction had to be like wildly imaginative. Like you had to make it up. I mean, not like you had to have a good imagination. You still have to have that. And so I thought I had to make something up. You know, I thought I had to write something that was like wildly new and new to me too. I did move the book to Amsterdam where I was living at the time. It just, you know, it was a great book. It was a strange experience publishing it. It took a while to come out. It was published at St. Martin's Press. The woman who edited it has gone on to have a really terrific career. But, you know, she was young. It didn't quite get the polish it needed. I had a lot of craft issues, which kind of bug me now. But I wouldn't trade it for the world. But it's just a weird book. Like, I didn't, you know, I hadn't gone to an MFA program yet. I sort of didn't know anything about, like, publishing. So I just thought my wild ideas were going to be what everyone wanted to hear. Apparently, that's not the case. You know, this is a business. And Even the most literary people know it's a business, you know, and they do write books that are somewhat targeted to certain things. I just thought I could write whatever I wanted. I'd like to go back to that sort of writing at some point, but you know, I have to figure it out a little more clearly.
Well, I think I met you at Literary Orange. I think Visitation Street had just come out,
That's correct.
and you were pregnant, and it was a while back. So Visitation Street is the book you were talking about that was sort of an accidental entree into the mystery community.
Exactly. You know, I wrote it. It was about the neighborhood I was living in Brooklyn called Red Hook, a sort of fringe community, kind of cut off from the rest of the borough. And so things go unnoticed there, crimes or vandalism or just people living their lives. And I wanted to write about the community. It happened that the story I came up with, a couple girls go out in the river in a raft in the first chapter, and you find out what happens to them in the last chapter, which my editor informed me about 6 months after we had finished the book that it was a mystery. It was when she showed me the cover. A little confused as to why it was dark and there was a quote from Dennis Lehane on it. It was really confusing to me. So, you know, she said, "Well, someone goes missing in the first page, and you find out what happened to them in the last page. What did you think you'd done?" I was like, I had no idea. And I don't even know how to write a mystery to this day. Like, I can't, like, I couldn't come up with a mystery plot. I can write a crime novel, which is slightly different because that's about behavior, I think. But, like, to solve a crime in a book, oh, word, that's not happening for me. Like, I have no idea.
So then Sing Her Down is your fifth. Yeah. Okay. So how has writing changed for you since the first one and then since Visitation Street, which propelled you into the crime writing genre?
Every book is so different. I mean, you know, I'm 47 now. I think I probably finished The Art of Disappearing when I was 28, 27, came out when I was 30-ish. Took a while. So I've been writing and publishing books for 20 years almost, which is bananas to me. And you know, you go through a lot of life changes. I think my life will be a little more stable going forward now. You know, I got married, I had a kid, I got divorced. I tried to figure out how to make a living. So, like, writing Visitation Street in graduate school was kind of relaxing. And then writing Wonder Valley, my next book, because I'd written Visitation Street and it did fairly well, and they told me I had to write a crime novel, was really stressful. And I kind of second-guessed everything. I wrote Sing Her Down during the pandemic, you know, and I had way less time to write. My daughter was doing distance learning or whatever they called it, distance learning, Zoom school. And she was young, so I had to do Zoom school every day with her or be around, so I couldn't really work. I'm a baby about work. I like to work in the morning. I like to work for a specific period of time. And then suddenly I was only able to work from like 3 to 5. And that was saying that was lucky. I mean, that was my hours. Our babysitter would come, you know, for the first year of the pandemic, it was just no help for 6 months, I guess. And, you know, that was a really compressed time period. So I wrote the book in 500 word increments, which for me seems bizarre. Now I can't imagine doing a book any other way. I don't remember the person who needed like 7 hours to write, you know, 4 pages. I need 7 hours from like 9 a.m. till 3 p.m. or I guess that's 6 hours to work on Visitation Street or Wonder Valley. You know, now I have a little more sort of patience for. It sounds like it's less patience, it's less time, but I have more patience for the process. And I think I go into each day with a little bit more of a sense of what I want to accomplish. And also, you know, some days you can write 300 words, but you'll eventually get a book out of it. So that's just really changed. You know, I am not one of these people who wants to sit down all day and work. Like, I want to work for like 4 hours maximum. I mean, on my writing, I have lots of other work I do. 4 hours, 3 hours, and that's enough for me. But they're good hours now. They're much better than they used to be.
We'll talk about Sing Her Down and how the story came about. I'm curious when you knew that it was a book, when the idea had traction and you went, this is a book, it's not anything but, and I have to do it.
It started as a bet with a friend in a bar before the pandemic. We are both huge fans of Cormac McCarthy, and for different reasons, he's, a macho Western writer from Montana, and I am a not of those things. But we both love Cormac, and we love him for the same reasons. And I was very interested in, well, I mean, some people don't like how violent his work is, but how he gets away with incredibly violent things, and but how masculine it is. And so I said I was going to write a female version of Blood Meridian. I had this like high blown idea of what that was going to be like. And then I started to take some notes, and I had to put it down because the pandemic started. And suddenly, I guess because I was feeling trapped at home, maybe trapped in some of the circumstances of my life, the idea of a prison, the novel is set in a prison at the beginning, came also because I really wanted to talk about criminality and violence. And I figured, like, if you wanted a group of violent women, you might best find them in a prison, whereas you can find a group of violent men in a lot of other places, like a bar. I would argue you can find a bunch of violent women in a bar, but that's just different. That's a different topic. So I knew it was a book from the beginning. I wanted to write about two violent women on some kind of in Blood Meridian, the kid and the judge are sort of in this like giant cat and mouse game all over the western border, I mean the southern border of Mexico. And I wanted to kind of mimic that with like two women who are sort of pursuing each other for violent means and violent ends. And it sort of evolved from there. I always knew it was going to be a book. I didn't know who was going to be in it, but it became pretty clear. The voices of Dios, the main character, and Florida came out day one.
Yeah, and also Skid Row is in it quite a lot. And I know that I don't know if you're still teaching classes down there, but you spent so much time on Skid Row. And I, as I read those sections, I thought, oh yeah, okay. Now she has actual experience in this place.
It's my second book set in Skid Row. Wonder Valley is more about my experience teaching there. I've taught at Skid Row for 11 years, and it'll be 12 this fall. And I didn't really mean to go back and write about it again, but right before the pandemic, I'd been doing a project that fell apart because of the pandemic. With a artist friend, a photographer, about the flowers that bloom along the freeway in Los Angeles, and sort of looking at the juxtaposition of this, like, wildflowers and sort of urban landscape and urban structures. And in doing that and exploring that, we were sort of traipsing around the berms and the freeway underpasses, and encountered a sort of different level or style of homelessness, I should say, than in Skid Row, like more encampments that were more like towns or cities or communities. But the homelessness was, it was extraordinary, the sprawl and the spread. It's changed a little bit now. That continued during the pandemic. The city just became completely covered with encampments and tents. And it was interesting to me, having written a book and having worked in Skid Row, to see this evolution of homelessness and unhoused living and different types of ad hoc structures. And then when my characters escape from prison, or they're not escape from prison, they skip parole and wind up on a bus to downtown LA, it just was two things that came together. It wasn't even a question. Like, we are going to see the Skid Row sprawl, or the homeless sprawl, that was unique to LA during the pandemic, that I don't think I saw anywhere else. I mean, it was extraordinary. It was heartbreaking. It was like a whole city had come and descended over the known city. And who's to argue which is the correct city? So I feel comfortable writing about stuff like that. And I think it's important.
So, and then you mentioned the pandemic. You started writing it during the pandemic, and the pandemic is in there, but very subtly. It's not like in your face pandemic.
I mean, no one's dying of COVID. We're not really dealing with hospitalization and the illness. The pandemic's sort of an engine. It's why these women get released from prison, because during the pandemic, people were obviously compassionately released for overcrowding. They're forced to quarantine in a hotel, which was something I was very interested in. I kept reading articles about prisoners being sent to motels to quarantine because they were released so quickly. And they had to check that they weren't going to bring COVID back home. I mean, I always find that sort of extraordinary that all the things that the government was worried about, it was prisoners bringing COVID back to their families. There are so many things that went unchecked, but this one was kind of like, oh, fine, put them in motels. What that experience might have been like to go from a prison to a motel. Or also homeless. There's a really interesting exhibit downtown in LA now at the LA Poverty Department. Of a called COVID Hotel about emergency healthcare during COVID. You would think that going to live in a hotel, having been homeless or having been, or say unhoused, or having been a prisoner would have been great, but apparently it's not great. And so I was sort of interested in that moment. We always take it for granted, oh, go to a hotel, it's better, but it was really isolating. So that was sort of how I wanted to use COVID as a way to examine various causes and results, but I wasn't particularly interested in like the disease or the spread of it or but there is this interesting thing. If you're writing about homelessness during the pandemic, and the phrase that we're always supposed to use is, safer at home. What is home? What is home when you live outside?
So when you are working on something, are you even thinking about the next project? Is it on your mind at all, or do you have to be completely done and it's sort of to the editor and you're on your, own and to do whatever?
Like I say, every book is different, and this one was particularly different because I also wound up getting divorced in the middle of writing it. So I could barely think about anything, barely this book. I was just trying to keep my life together and move and figure out how to stabilize things for my kid. And the fact that I wrote this book, I don't really know how it happened. It wasn't until I moved into my new apartment alone and I took a breath that I actually read the whole manuscript. And I was like, wow, I wrote a book. It's actually not bad. And there's a lot of themes of the last couple of years of my life in the pages. I couldn't think outside like a paragraph, let alone the next project. I just completed a short novel or a novella. And because it's short, I was able to think about other things, but also I'm sort of thinking of writing a companion piece to it. But no, I'm a pretty one-trick pony. Like, I don't understand. Like, people are writing three books, two screenplays. I'm like, no, one thing, I have like one idea at a time, and it's like I'll have it for 3 years, I don't have a list of book ideas anywhere.
Well, this felt like a more personal book than your others. It just, I don't know. It just, when I was drawn into it, and then it just started feeling really personal, even though obviously these characters are not you, and et cetera, but that's interesting,
Argue that they're all of us. That's one of the things I wanted to do. I mean, they're extremely violent, and I am not extremely violent. I am extremely angry at times. I was extremely angry for a long time, which is funny because I don't come across as extremely angry. I'm extremely sad. But what I tried to do with the different characters, there's Dios, who's incredibly violent. There's Florida, who is also incredibly violent, but in denial of it, and a rich girl. And there's a detective who is envious of their violence and who's been oppressed at work. I kind of was hoping that everyone, and then there's a woman named Case who narrates some of the book, who's in prison, and she's more of a traditional criminal. She's killed somebody, but it was an accident, or she did it. It wasn't really, it was a crime of passion. It wasn't premeditated. I hope, though this is a weird hope, that everyone who's sort of struggled, or women especially, with rage or oppression, and we all have, or sexism or misogyny or workplace mistreatment, can find something in this book that they he she relates to. I certainly can. It might just be minor. It might just be your partner telling you you don't know how to park the car. And like these little instances of insidious emotional misogyny. I don't think men say that to men. And like, if you can read this book and that's see your experience there, like people I hear so many stories, these little things. A woman I know, she was telling me about her first year at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and a man said something just horrible to her, and it derailed her writing career for years, just like a comment. And I think that's personal because all women have experienced these things. Not that the women in my book are violent because of what men's done to them, but it does give them a fulcrum for it. I want to be very clear that I do not want to write about women who are violent because they're mistreated by men, but they're angry because they've been mistreated by men.
It was pretty clear.
Good. Thank you.
Before we bring Ivy back on, a few words about Patreon. If you've been listening to the show for a while, then you've heard us talk about Patreon as a way you can help Marie and me to bring the show to you. If you've gleaned anything from the show that's helped you along your writing path, please consider becoming a patron. Visit Patreon at our page, patreon.com/writersonwriting. Buying your books at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting also helps us and indie bookstores. On our page, you'll find books by authors who've been on the show, as well as books Marie and I recommend. And now, more with Ivy Pakoda. So the four characters, Kate, Dios, Lobos, and Florida, did they all come to you at once too? Or was it Dios and Florida that began the book, and then you found, you know, you pulled in the cop, you pulled in Case? I mean, how'd that go? All the characters that...
Excuse me. You know, Dios and Florida came at once. They were really sort of, the idea was like using... I mean, it's gone so far from this, but it was just using the thought exercise of recreating Blood Meridian. You know, the kid in Blood Meridian doesn't think that he is like violent, and then the judge draws it out of him, and they go in this sort of endless pursuit of each other, and they're fixated on each other. It's like a fixation. And so I wanted to write about this like mutual fixation of these two women linked through violence. I can't write an entire novel set in prison, nor do I wish to read one. I had to break them out. And once they did something pretty bad on outside of prison, I realized I wanted to have someone pursuing them. Also, I wanted to create a character who might be more accessible to a reader who does not relish female violence as a way to understand her own issues. So I thought, well, maybe a woman who's, you know, suffering at work because of her sex or gender, you know, would help. So then Case, you know, I'm not exactly sure when I created her. She was always Florida's roommate. That I knew. Oh, I remember when I really wanted to turn up the gas around it being a Western. I thought I should have one of those like Western campfire narration type voices. And that turned out to be Case. And also, again, for people who don't want to look at violent women in prison, why don't we look? We love stories of, you know, redeemed women in prison. And I listen to this Canadian podcast about women in prison. And it's always, they're more similar to Case's story, like things that, you know, circumstances, a tough upbringing, you know, drugs, abuse. So she sort of represents a more traditional view on why women are violent. And the others are just violent because they damn well are. And I'm proud of it.
Well, I'd love to hear you read. My next question, I think, has to do with the beginning of the book. So maybe you read first and I ask the question.
Perfect. Okay, the book starts with Case, so... Let me tell you a story. I know everybody's story. Been collecting them for years. A goddamn library of voices filed away in my head. Sometimes there's not much to tell. But you'll want to hear this one. It's about two women. Two women in a world of women cut off from the world of men until they weren't. You won't believe what women can do. These women, their mistake was in thinking they burned with their own unique rage, something deeper, darker than what the rest of us feel. Let me tell you, inside we all rage the same. It's how we let it out that differs. The story ends 7 hours west of here, but a few miles short of the ocean. Like the women in it ran but didn't make it all the way. Ran from this desert but failed to find the water. That's some raw luck to fall before you catch the ocean breeze. Gotta suspect that shit can wash away some sin. Couldn't hurt to try. But maybe they didn't want to make it that far. Maybe that wasn't part of their plan, part of their story. To each, you know. Now, I don't know what all happened between here and there. I only know what I've been told. What I've been told about is a mural. You probably think that's some bullshit, that I'm wasting your time talking about something spray painted on a wall in a city I've never even been to. But I'm telling you, I heard it's a real something. I'm going to see it one day, fly this coop and check it with my own eyes. So this mural's painted behind a gas station at the corner of Olympic and Western in Los Angeles. Until recently, those streets' names meant nothing to me, but now they're coming into focus. As far as I know, it's just another intersection of bad and worse, trouble running in either direction. As far as I can tell, it's where this story ends. Thing is, this mural isn't just any mural. People say it's alive. People say it jumps and moves. People are always saying crazy shit. People always thinking I'm saying crazy shit. After all, I got the voices in my head and I'm not going to lie about that. You know what I thought when I first heard about this living mural, this paint job that moves? I thought motherfuckers been so cooped up, so safer at home, flattening the curve that they've gone out of their minds. Motherfuckers been breathing through these fucking masks so long they've oxygen deprived themselves. A living mural, my ass. But then I realized it makes sense. All these voices in my head, the victims dropped by the women in here, they live on in me. So why the fuck couldn't that mural be alive? Why couldn't that story keep telling itself? Over time, I've seen a lot more that's made a lot less sense.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So, my question is, was this always the prologue? Did you always
No.
like, did you know you wanted to have a prologue? And how can I?
Yeah, it was slightly different. The prologue was the ending of the book for a long time. I had that up front, and that was the kind of thing that circles back to that. But instead, the prologue sort of tells the story of the ending of the book because I wanted that dramatic, sort of very Western style endings. The book is sort of inspired by, Westerns without giving it away. But yeah, I love prologues. I'm a huge fan. I know a lot of writing instructors are like, prologues are terrible. I think they're amazing.
I think prologues are great when they, I don't know, well, obviously when they add something, but sometimes it seems like prologues either go on too long or they're in italics
Or
or,
they give too much away. They
yeah.
tell you what they tell you what to read for.
Right.
I needed this. One of the reasons I wanted to have a prologue is I didn't want anyone to think I was writing a prison novel. And when you start a book in prison, it's like a third of it is in the prison. I want people to understand we're not going to be stuck in prison the whole time.
Interesting. And then you circle back to Case at the end.
Yep.
She ends the book.
Little joy in there. A little light shining in.
Yeah. So, how about writing about a real place? I mean, you're in LA for the most part, in this novel. And so, in LA is real as we know it. How beholden are you then to writing about real locations, or do you mix it up? Are you writing about fictional locations as well, making up places?
Until this novella that I just wrote, I only wrote about places that were outside my window. Except for that first novel, which I had trouble with. Visitation Street was written about the block outside my window. Wonder Valley was set in Skid Row and kind of in the near the Arts District where I was living at the time. These Women was definitely set in my neighborhood that I was living in. I live on Western or lived on Western, or block away. And Sing Her Down, same thing, set in the same area. I've just written a novella that's set in Greece, which is weird. I mean, I've recently been there. It was really hard for me. And I had to really reduce that to a couple of locations, like a luxury hotel and a beach. It's set on an island I've been to, but it felt uncomfortable. I'm like, let's get back to LA in the desert, but I don't want to be like the LA novelist, I have to write something else. But I miss it. I'm like, what's going on outside my window? Let's see.
So why don't you want to be the LA novelist?
I just think it's I don't mind, there are just so many, and I think it's good to break it up and I'm not from LA. I have a wider palette to play with, so I'm not sure why Greece. But yeah, I might write a book set in Brooklyn again. I was thinking about it, or in Amsterdam, where I lived for a very long time for 7 years. Thinking about it.
So there are so many twists in this novel, and I can't recall whether you were a plotter, if you kind of knew where you were going and what you were going to do, but maybe talk about, how you did that and how you kept track of everything.
Wow. I'm glad to hear you say that they're twists. I think it's very linear and like not a lot happens. Because this is like the most plotty, like propulsive book I've written. I just knew that I wanted to get these women into a confrontation on Western Avenue. That's all I knew. I was like, they're in prison and they're gonna wind up here. And that's all I knew. They're going to get from Arizona, because more they're more kind of high security women's prisons in Arizona. As are based at on a real one in Perryville. And I needed them to skip parole. So that's right. They had to be out of state because they needed to come to California. That's the big issue. That's all I knew. There's two women, and they were going to wind up in this violent confrontation, and that was enough plot for me. I knew that I wanted to take them a little tour of various events. Like they were going to get out, and probably something you do when you get out of prison, you go drink too much. And I knew I wanted something like that, but that's all I knew. Then I had this vision of the, I don't really outline, but I kind of have a vision of the way I wanted the book to look in my head. And I kind of wanted there to be this section in the middle that wasn't about them. And it was about the detective and sort of, you know, there's one section and then there's like this skinny section and then there's this other section. So, you know, that's, I don't really, I see things visually. It's not helpful to other people, but it's very helpful to me. Like I saw these women as like all these blocks of story that overlap just a tiny bit, but each one is discrete and finished. Each character tells her own story in one sort of finished chunk.
And then keeping track of it all. How do you do that? I mean, would you go back and read what you wrote the day before and keep going, or like how does that work for you?
This doesn't seem very hard to keep track of. It's like two women on the run. They're just here in LA and someone's chasing them and not a lot. I mean, so yeah, I guess I write pretty slowly and carefully. I don't rush ahead if I don't know something. So it's pretty clear in my head. And then I'm always like scribbling notes to myself about, you know, the outline as I see it, or where I want it to end. So, you know, my notebooks are just filled with these sort of like weird drawings of, you know, how I think the book is developing. But no, I don't have like an I don't have a way to keep track or Scrivener or anything. It's just all in my head.
But it sounds like you're keeping notebooks and
Oh, I have tons of notebooks.
in that way.
Oh, I have notebook. Yeah, I write everything out. I take notes sort of compulsively, although they're probably meaningless to anybody else. It's just I often write in a notebook as I'm writing to keep track of my, you know, thoughts, because sometimes I will forget what I want to do. I'll like, you know, that's frustrating.
So setting, you know, I remember you once you said when you don't know what to write, you write setting. And there's so much setting in here that's so wonderful. And so every time I came to like a section that was really kind of descriptive about place, I'm like, now does she not know where to go with this? Or does she just do this really well?
This one's different because I really wanted to write about what it was like to be in Los Angeles during the pandemic, and the setting was really important to me. It sort of mirrors my pandemic experience. I was let out of jail for an hour and a half every day after the homeschooling, and I took a walk. You know, I couldn't get in my car. You know, I don't know why I'd drive somewhere and walk there. I would took the same walk. I had two walks that I would take in West Adams. One down to Country Club Park and over to Olympic, and a little bit north towards Wilshire, and the other way south to Crenshaw and 24th Street. And over this foot pedestrian footbridge over the 10, which figures large in the book, the 10. And the setting is really, that was my pandemic experience, is watching these places on foot and learning LA on foot. And when the women in my book come to LA on a bus, obviously they're in the pandemic, they're criminals, they don't have a car, they're walking through LA. So like the setting became part of the story, and it also reflected my sort of pandemic experience.
So what do you do when you hit a wall and you just, you know, you have time to write, you're going to write now, you're here, but I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. Well, maybe this or that. I mean, what do you do?
Oh, I just don't write. I mean, like if I don't know what to do, it's there's I really I mean I know it's a weird thing to say, there's no point. I you know, sometimes I'll go back and read what I wrote and try to polish it and see if there's something I can find. But like you know, I've been at this for a while now, which is so weird to say. It's odd. You know, these women sing her down, and this novella I wrote, I didn't really get stuck, because I just had this idea of, you know, I always think of just like, let's get from someone on the macro level from point A to point B. Let's get these women from Perryville, Arizona, to a standoff on Western. Or let's get them in a more micro level from the Union Station where they've come on a train across town on foot. So if everyone has to get, if every writing day has a goal to get somewhere, I'd sort of break it down to little stages. That's why I'm never lost as to what happens next. I make mistakes. I write scenes that don't work. I write places that don't work, but I always have a little bit of a time. I set like micro goals. There's like a mat. It's like one of my writing teachers in grad school said, you know, the only outline she needed was, you know, let's say you're taking a trip from New York to Los Angeles. You just go, you know, west, and eventually you turn left when you hit the coast, and that's enough of an outline. I feel the same way. I'm like, I need to get these people into this position. So basically, they're going to take this bus, you know, straight across, and that's one dist, and then somehow then go north on Western. Or, you know, what are the baby steps? Like, how do we get them to that bus? Like, what is the step to get onto that bus? Okay, what's it like in the pandemic to get on a bus? Like, you need cash. What's it like to have cash if you're an inmate? So I've described the credit card, you know, the J card that you get when you get out of jail. So there's always a little thing to do. I don't think I would write if I didn't really know where the story was going.
I love the guy, the homeless man that is more of a philosopher and talks about feet. Like feet are really a big deal to him. Like, you know, they tell everything. Where did he come from?
That's just a oh let's see gosh, he's the one who talks about a cat, right? You know, I can't remember. The feed thing is a real thing. So like if you are sick on and taken to a hospital from the street, like one of the ways they determine, sometimes I've read about this, level of care or the level of mental illness is through foot care. And a lot, there are a lot of organizations that go to Skid Row to help people, pedicures, hygiene, but feet is like a really big deal. You know, I also like with elder care too. I think that's more with elder care, actually. There's a lot of assessments of people's like mental health, and also physical health is like whether their feet are in good shape, because it's a sign of, you know, taking care of yourself, but also a lot of disease comes in that way. So he's sort of aware of that. You know, that story about being a landscape gardener and a fire, somebody told me that story. I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was someone. He's inspired by someone I met in Skid Row, but not someone who was unhoused, because I wouldn't. He's a, yeah, I can't really remember. And then I was, you know, he's really into trading, like the currency of the street, like what we consider valuable, someone who might not have a roof over their head considers different value money, you know. So money is changed into currency of objects, and I was sort of interested in this trading up, trading down, and trading different objects. So yeah, he's sort of inspired by an amalgam of people who've come through my writing workshop, I would probably say safely.
Why do you keep teaching there?
Oh, I love it. It's so much fun. You know, my workshop is ever evolving. It's very funny. But the guy who is the organizer of sort of the umbrella group where I teach, although we all have different roles now, we're always changing it. And I love the idea that there's art and community in a place where people don't expect that there's art and community. You know, what some people think is Skid Row is not what I think is Skid Row. Yes, of course, there is the superficial vision of homelessness, which is accurate. You know, somebody passed out on the street who can't help themselves, someone in a severe mental health or addiction crisis, families on the street, there's all of that. And of course, that is nothing that, but all, within that, there's a lot of, you know, humanity that's completely overlooked. I was doing a photo shoot down there for an article I wrote, which makes me uncomfortable. And a woman came up and asked me what we're doing. And then, you know, she lived in a tent on 7th. And she got her phone out and read all these poems to me. They're like really good. You know, it wasn't, you know, and she really thought about it. And I gave her my phone number. She called me about coming to the workshops. And, you know, I love it. I love it. I love the art. I love the open mic nights. You know, it's just fun and unusual and surprising and sort of kind of like the last bastion of outsider art in a major city, I would argue.
What was the hardest part of writing Singer Down?
Getting divorced in the middle of it. you know, no, that's not true. It was, yes, that's true, technically. The hardest part was to not justify why the women are violent. I kept going back and writing backstory for Dios about, you know, something that happened to her that made her this way. And the whole exercise was to not do that, you know, was to write about women being violent without giving them the excuses that we so conventionally see, or so often conventionally see in film and TV, like the Eileen Wuornos story, which is a true story. She's a prostitute who killed a bunch of people and played by the beautiful Charlize Theron, so it must be important, you know, like, which is not to belittle any of that project, but like that's what we like. We like, you know, we like revenge stories and, you know, women getting one over on their abusive husband and taking the kids. That's all well and good, and that's real, and that happens. Or we get like weird Black Widow psychopaths in fiction who are just like beyond category, not real characters. Like, there's, I mean, if there were that many Black Widows in the world as there are in like domestic thrillers, we'd be in a lot of trouble. But, you know, or like women who have like a split personality and they don't really know about their, you know. I'm going to stop calling out specific books because in my head I am. But I wanted to write without any of those burdens, but I kept writing like, and this is something that happened to this person as a youngster, and this is, you know, this abuse, and just getting rid of that was like, it was so hard to not do it.
Well, Florida has a mother who is a bit dicey in terms of her care for Florida or Florence when she was a child.
You know, yeah, dicey, but also like, could I name 10 moms like that? Yes, I can. And sometimes it's fun, you know, like they're rich, and you know, she sort of lets her daughter hang out with older guys and just kind of trust that she's okay. Doesn't really, you know, want to believe Florida. Florida is not violent because she was abused. I want to make that clear. Nor is she a sociopath. She just has, you know, these kind of reactions to things. You know, I remember being in high school. I grew up in a very artsy world, in Brooklyn, and I had friends whose parents would like let them smoke weed and have older boyfriends or girlfriends. And I thought that was like super cool, you know. I was like, oh wow. And then you know, I had friends who went drinking with their parents, smoked at home. Now as a parent myself, I have opposing thoughts, though they're not as strict as my other people would have thought. But you know, that can really backfire. And what looks amazing from a child's perspective isn't so great often. Sometimes it can be just fine. So you know, Florida's mom does not think she's doing, that's what I love about the people in this book. No one thinks they're doing a bad thing. She's like, this is cool, you know, like my kid's having a good time. And she is negligent, but also like in denial about some of the choices she's made. And also Florida's making some of her own choices too, that the mom is unaware of.
Right. Okay, so you got a draft, you finished the draft, then what? What happened then? What, how does your revision process go, or are your pages pretty clean the way you work so that it's not like a heavy duty kind of rewrite?
They're pretty clean. If there's a problem in the middle, I'll stop working and try to figure out what the next step is. So it was pretty clean. I sent this book out early before I met, like, I just sent it to my agent, and we submitted it really quickly. So, you know, I tend not to let people read my work when I'm working on it. Very, very few. I changed that up this time with this new book I'm working on because it's so different. But yeah, I sent it out, sent it to my agent. She liked it, sent it to my editor, sent it to a bunch of editors, you know. And it sold pretty quickly. But I do sort of go slowly when I'm writing, you know, like I have a sense, like all the painful part of what comes next, I'm doing every day, as opposed to, I know people who get to the end, and many of my friends like that, like, let's see what I've got. I'm like, that would make me so nuts. To get there, I'm worrying as I go. I can't just produce stuff to see what happens.
Are you reading fiction as you write?
Yes, I
And
am.
what you read, is it like sort of like what you're writing, or is it like totally different, or doesn't it matter? It's just fiction.
Before I start to write, I read things that are either thematically or like, okay, so I read a ton of Westerns the summer before I started to write this book. I wrote read like 30 Western. No, that's a lot. 20 Westerns. And Then, if I'm stuck in the book, I'll read something. Like I kept looking through Dennis Johnson's Angels. But no, when I'm writing, I try to read things that are slightly different because, it gets a little confusing. But I've done a lot, I've done all of that part beforehand. It's like my kind of research is to read books that are either emotionally or thematically or structurally in line with what I want to do. But I can read it. I teach too, so I have to read all the time. I review books. So, if you ask me the last book I read, well, actually, do I know the last book I read for fun? Yes. Oh, yeah, totally. So, yeah, I mean, I read when I'm writing. It doesn't really bother me. I try not to read anything too on the nose, though.
Dennis Johnson's Angels keeps coming up. I think the
Oh, yeah.
last writer I talked to for the podcast mentioned it as well.
Got it.
Who was it? Alex Sammartino.
Okay, weird. It's a really fringe book, but I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I think it's telling me I need to read this book because I have never read Angels or anything by Dennis Johnson, really.
Oh, it's very violent. Read Jesus' Son.
Really? Before Angels? So you have also started teaching out at the low residency for UCR.
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you see writers doing that you wish they wouldn't do?
Oh, wow. I mean, lots of
Right.
things. Gosh, that's a complicated question.
Well, then let me ask you this. How do you teach writing? Like, how?
One of the things that I think writers are doing, which I think they should, are they're just so aware now of the publishing industry, and they're really worrying about publishing when they're writing as opposed to writing a book.
Right.
Which I sort of, I just don't let my students ask me about agent queries and submissions and, that stuff if I can avoid it. I just feel like that muddies the waters. In the same way that I think that there's a whole group of novelists living, especially in LA, who are worried about getting their books into the development. And I think that's coloring the process. I think, I want people to write and I want people to also understand that, like, it's going to take a while and like you're going to have to revise, and just because you're in graduate school doesn't mean you're going to emerge with a book, and that's okay too. So how do I teach writing? One of the things I do is I try to figure out why someone's trying to tell a specific story, and especially someone who's revised it a million times and like can't get there. I think it's people. Oh, here's something. I wish writers would stop adding stuff to their books to try to fix holes, as opposed to figuring out what's already there and why it's there and trying to find the story that's already on the page. I think people try to like complicate and rebuild and so, the add more and more and more, as opposed to, I think there's like this elegant symmetry when you're reading through your work and you're like, oh, that's why that character is doing this. It's usually in there. There's usually a reason you've done something, and it's always fun to sort of find that and figure it out, as opposed to just like jamming more stuff. I was talking to a new student today and she's like, well, I'm writing this bee tree, but I want to have a murder plot and then I have this. I'm like, okay, like that sounds great, but is that what you want to write, or is it something you think is going to make it better? Because what was the original idea?
I wonder how much of that goes along with what you just said or what you started saying in terms of, I want this to be, optioned for a movie, so I better make it like this or do this or.
A lot of it, I'd say. I don't care about stuff like that. I'd love the money, and my things do get optioned. They don't get made as of yet. But I think that people are way too aware of, when, okay, so I think it's very important to be aware to, I think it's important to write a book with the idea that you're going to finish it and sell it, because writing is an act of ego. And I think that's really important. And I think that, like, if you don't believe your book is worth reading or publishing, you shouldn't get up in the morning and write it, because what's the point, I mean, there's lots of different publishing, and not saying just to say, oh, I'm going to write an international bestseller, but like if it's worth writing, it's worth finishing. And I think that's good. But on the flip side of that is this hyper awareness of the market, like in these like little micro areas. Like someone's like, well, this is like, I'm trying to write like space tech, sci-fi, space horror. I'm like, whoa, okay. Like, there's a niche here, and this publisher does that, and that agent does that. I said, well, that's great at the very end, but going in with all that stuff in your brain, it's sort of like there's going to be time in the future when you're at my stage in your career where you remember everything everyone ever criticized about your books, and you're like, am I doing that again? There's enough time for voices in your head. And I think too much awareness of the market or thinking about the business when you haven't finished the book can be very detrimental.
Do you read reviews?
Not really. I mean, I skim them. You know, I skim them. I do. I'm aware of them. It's kind of just laziness. I don't care. Like, you know, what's it gonna do? Unless, I mean, yeah, I don't care one way or the other. I mean, yeah, I guess I do read them, but sometimes I don't.
Well, we are getting to the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any tips, any more tips or words of wisdom for the writers listening.
Yeah, I mean, when I teach, I sort of consider myself more of a novel therapist than a teacher. I just think that like there's a reason that you've decided to tell a particular story. The reason might be I want to be the next Clive Cussler and have my books in the remainder bin at like Target. But within that decision, there's something that drew you to the story. And I think sometimes people get so far away from that. And I try to like go back, teach my students, like go back and figure out what that core idea was that really drew you to this project before you started layering things on it. And before you want to add to something, see if you can work with what's there, you know? And I can't stress this enough. Like sometimes the idea is already on the page, but you haven't noticed it. And when you find it, it's such a cool feeling.
That's great advice.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ivy. It's been a
Thank
pleasure once again, and you will be on my panel at the LA Times Book Fest on April 22nd at 2 o'clock in
Thanks for
Hoffman.
the reminder of the time. Hotman too. Cool. Yeah, thank you. It was such a treat. What a great interview. I'm always glad to be here.
Thank you. That was Ivy Pakoda, author of Sing Her Down. Thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen, and a huge thanks to our Patreon supporters who help make this show possible. I have a Substack page called Pen on Fire, where I talk about writing and do interviews with authors and agents, many of whom have been on the show. Thank you, Travis Barrett, for your music and sound editing. And if you like the music you hear on the show, you can find more typewriter music on Spotify under the artist Just My Type. Travis also has original music on Spotify under his name, Travis Barrett. You can access our archive of shows, thousands by now, at writersonwriting.com. And if you want to get in touch, email writersonwritingpodcast@gmail.com. You can reach Travis at travisbarrettcreative@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and in the meantime, stay in the chair.